Chapter 5. Medic. It was 6 days since the North Side ration drop. They'd managed to make their government-given provisions stretch the whole week, but only by supplementing them with the food from their own supply on at least 3 occasions. Being underweight was not something Lucy's father had ever valued in a human being. It was impractical and goddamn ungrateful, as he'd put it during her high school crash dieting phase. He'd been right, of course. A malnourished farm worker was no kind of worker at all. You needed strength to be useful. Both she and Dan were still adjusting to the 500-calorie reduction in their daily intake. Lucy flopped onto the bar stool that evening, kicking off her shoes and bringing her left leg up to rest across her right as she began to massage the ball of her foot.
"Long day?" called Dan from the bedroom.
Before Lucy could answer, the overhead lights flicked on, accompanied by the familiar clunk and hum of the refrigerator buzzing back to life.
"Oh my God," she cried, jumping to her feet. "Oh my God!"
She marveled at the ceiling lights as if seeing them for the first time. Dan rushed from the bedroom, a stream of joyful expletives tumbling out as he bounded towards her. The two jumped and whooped with unbridled glee.
"Phones!"
he exclaimed, suddenly rushing away to reunite his defunct device with a charger. Lucy ran the other way and into the bathroom.
"Oh, sweet Lord, it flushes! It flushes! And the shower's working, too!"
"The TV stations are still down," called Dan from the lounge.
"Maybe they didn't know the power was coming back on,"
said Lucy, joining him, breathless with excitement.
"Good point. I'll leave it switched to the news channel in case it comes back. Hey, do you think..."
Dan paused, moving quickly over to the window and lifting the curtain back.
"Luce, the streetlights are back on. And look, people!"
The street lighting brought Lucy an overwhelming sensation of comfort. The muffled jubilation of neighbors above and below them resonated through the floorboards as Lucy took in the families and individuals dancing in their homes across the street, their rooms illuminated for the first time since the satellites failed.
"Hello! Hey!"
said Dan, waving emphatically at a family almost directly opposite them who were also at their window taking in the phenomenon.
They waved back, the kids jumping as they did so. Everyone's usual social inhibitions and norms stripped away in the face of this overwhelming, unifying return to normality. One of the kids stopped bouncing and began pointing to the right of Dan and Lucy. The girl's parents followed her gaze, their smiles faltering. Following the direction in which the child was pointing, Lucy's eyes tracked across the street and all the way to her and Dan's kitchen.
"Shit!"
she cried, rushing through and hastily drawing the blinds closed.
"What?"
quizzed Dan, letting the lounge curtain swing back into place.
"They saw our rations."
The innocent curiosity vanished from Dan's face. They'd let their guard down.
"How much did they see?"
he asked, catching up with her in the kitchen.
"All the packs on the counter, all the water. This cupboard door was open, so I guess all the tins in here. Fuck!"
she cried. Dan paced up and down.
"This isn't good."
"No, no, it's okay," quavered Lucy. "The power's back on now, so actually, we don't need to worry, right?" Dan pursed his lips.
"New rule," he decreed. "We keep nothing valuable inside of the windows, or the door for that matter."
Lucy's shoulders dropped.
"Agreed."
She closed the cupboard and started to shift the gallons of water up against the wall out of sight.
"Hey, the radio should work now."
Dan seized the radio, flicking it on and immediately switching to AM, scrolling until he found KGO 810. Somehow, it was still broadcasting. As he turned the dial up, bringing the babble into focus, it sounded like they were attempting an outside broadcast. The studio commenter's clear voice was being interspersed by terrible quality audio from a number of interviewees, presumably passing by the street outside the studio.
"What do you think of the power coming back on?"
asked the reporter on the ground.
"It's fucking amazing!" cried the random interviewee. "It's, I don't know, like, we're back, baby, we're back!" "Yeah, we gonna get wasted,"
interrupted another, sending both into fits of laughter.
"Party on the streets! Streetlight party! Streetlight party!"
echoed the first, laughing wildly.
"So, you're planning on disobeying the curfew tonight?"
probed the reporter.
"Fuck the curfew! The power's back on, yo! It's party time!"
yelled the more excitable one. "Laters!"
"Yeah, laters!"
repeated the other one as they disappeared out of the microphone's range with diminishing cries of
"Streetlight party!"
cutting through the background hubbub.
For those of you just tuning in, resumed the anchor, you're listening to KGO 810. Our reporters are live on the streets of San Francisco getting your reactions to the restoration of power. I want to remind listeners again of the statement we've received from the authorities because it's somewhat different to the responses you're hearing on the street. And I ought to reiterate that the curfew has not been lifted, so please do not take risks. I know many of you will be excited tonight, but I would personally urge you to be cautious. Lucy slumped down on a bar stool and faced the radio. The authorities, continued the anchor, say they're proud to have achieved partial restoration of power, but are warning that the supply remains limited across California. So as I understand it, we'll be sharing the supply with other cities on a rotational basis. I'm told that City Hall is working towards publishing some sort of power timetable to help citizens plan accordingly. But as it stands, I'm afraid that power will be supplied for 2-hour periods only. I repeat, there'll be 2 hours of power. Then that's it until the next round, folks. You heard it here first. It's the hydroelectric plants, declared Lucy the next day after work. I heard one of the officers talking about it. They've managed to get some of them generating again, but they can only have so many plants online because they're on manual, which apparently takes like 5 times the number of staff, and we don't have enough people trained yet. Plus, you need loads more people overseeing the actual grid distribution 24/7 to make sure the rotation's working. So, yeah, fun fact, turns out automation was really friggin' useful. What about Diablo Canyon? Asked Dan while jimmying open a ration tin. Surely a nuclear plant's the obvious place to start. No idea, said Lucy. That's probably because I work in a bottle factory and only get my highly classified information through rumors and by flirting heavily with the military escorts. Dan pulled a less than impressed face and returned to his unedifying meal. Oh, geez, Dan, relax, she chuckled. I'm only kidding. If it's any consolation, I picture you every time.
You're the actual worst. What if I've got some sexy army mistress down at the depot? For all you know, I could be having dozens of wild affairs in the warehouse.
I think we both know that the thing turning you on in that warehouse is the neat orderly rows of itemized boxes.
Nothing wrong with that,
winked Dan. There are a couple of things, actually.
Hey, can you imagine what this is going to be like come winter? We'll be okay, but what's it going to be like for someplace like Chicago if there's still no power?
I imagine they'll do what people in Alaska are probably doing right now. Burn things, replied Lucy bluntly.
Surefire way to lose the deposit, Dan retorted, looking around the apartment.
I could go for some fire making. It'd be nostalgic. Relive the glory years of a misspent youth.
I hate to break it to you, Luce, but when people say misspent youth, they normally mean they wasted it playing video games or something, not cattle ranching. That's called child labor.
Yeah, but it means come winter, I'll be the one making us a mean bonfire, she grinned back. Although my source at the bottle factory informs me it'll all be fixed by next week, she added, cracking open a tin of tuna from the cupboard. And so far, he's only been wrong 100% of the time. Dinner.
Another 3 days passed before their city's turn for power came up again. The only places receiving electricity regularly, according to Lucy's ever-reliable source, were the hospitals and prisons. Food was concerning her more, though. Yesterday's state-given ration pack had felt lighter than the first, something confirmed by her neighbors' faces. The afternoon, however, had brought some relief. It was payday for all City Hall employees. Shifts finished early, and workers were bussed back to City Hall to collect their bonus rations in person. It also meant Dan and Lucy could take the second bus home together. The evening was mild. In the 2 weeks since global satellite failure, temperatures had risen to several degrees higher than normal for mid-fall. As they walked homeward, back up their steep road and away from the bus stop, ration parcels tucked under their arms, a gentle tide of feathery seeds danced in the wind, like dandelion seeds, only with a golden hue. Lucy tracked a swirling seed until it drew her eye to an elderly man across the street. His stooping frame was adorned by a long trench coat which he held together tightly at the collar, his other hand securing a dark blue woolly hat atop his head. His steps were small and unsteady. As the bus pulled away behind them, disappearing behind the next block, the sound of the man's coughing became louder and more violent until suddenly he fell to his knees, collapsing forward onto his frail torso, his entire body convulsing on the ground as each retching cough gripped him.
Oh, God! exclaimed Lucy, watching the man fall. A young couple nearby ran to him. "Somebody get a doctor!" cried the young man as he and the woman rolled the elderly patient onto his back. "You go to them. I'll get help," cried Lucy to Dan, and she ran towards the intersection. She scanned the street in both directions. There was a patrol vehicle, but it was driving away from their block.
"Hey! Hey, help!"
she yelled, desperately jumping and waving her arms. She began to sprint after the truck, continuing to shout until one of the soldiers heard her. The patrol stopped in its tracks and turned around.
"Help!"
she shouted again, urgently beckoning them to follow. The patrol quickly caught up and radioed for an ambulance, while Lucy returned to Dan's side. She stood only a yard from the old man's feet, watching in horror as the first couple on the scene tried desperately to resuscitate him. The patient's white hairs rippled gently as the strangers pummeled his ribcage. It cracked loudly under the compressions. The woman pinched the old man's nose and tilted his chin back, unflinchingly placing her mouth on his and trying in vain to revitalize him with secondary oxygen at set intervals. But each time, his inanimate head simply lolled to the side, his mouth hanging open as if beckoning to his dislodged blue hat a few inches away. The two soldiers stood back from the fallen man and watched as the civilians continued their attempts to save him. The sound of the ambulance's siren approached, and Lucy felt Dan's hand on her wrist.
"We need to get indoors, now,"
he said quietly, pulling her away from the scene and back towards their apartment.
"I'll explain inside."
Lucy worked to keep up with him as he quickly climbed their stairwell, taking it two steps at a time for the entire 8 floors. Her mind was fixating on the image of the fallen man. They'd witnessed the life force vanish from his body, sending his frail, discarded shell crashing to the ground. The last she saw was the ambulance crew scooping him up onto a stretcher and loading him into the back of the vehicle, while the other couple watched on hopelessly.
"Did you see the paramedics?"
panted Dan, taking the apartment key from his pocket as they reached the 8th floor. Even in the short bouts of power, he refused to let them take the elevator, insisting that it wasn't worth getting trapped. At least the stairwell lights were working.
"Luce,"
he persisted, opening the front door and stepping into their illuminated apartment.
"What? Yeah?"
she said, hastily refocusing as she followed him inside.
"They were wearing face masks,"
he said.
"Okay,"
replied Lucy, pulling off her shoes.
"Think about it. What else was wrong?"
An old guy just dropped dead on the street? Dan, I'm gonna say that's pretty fucking wrong,"
she snapped. Lucy felt him place a gentle hand on either shoulder. She lifted her chin and looked him straight in the eyes.
"Luce, I'm not being flippant. This matters,"
he insisted.
"Think about what we just saw. Think about what didn't stack up. Where were the military?"
She paused for a moment to think, then began to reevaluate what she'd seen. "They stood back from the old man, away from him. They didn't help the couple trying to save him."
"Good. What else?"
The paramedics were putting him into a body bag. They didn't even try a defibrillator or anything. They just decided he was dead."
"Right,"
said Dan, relaxing his arms and rubbing his cheeks. "So we both saw the same things, and I'm not losing my mind. That's something, then, at least."
"Why, what do you think that means?" pressed Lucy.
"I think it means they made two assumptions. One, they knew his death was a foregone conclusion, which itself means they probably know what killed him. Two, they know it's contagious, which is why they had masks and put him straight into containment. And the military knew to stay several yards away."
"But if they know what he died of,"
considered Lucy, fast-forwarding through the events all over again,
"then that must mean that other people have already died of it."
Dan reached into the kitchen cupboard and pulled out 2 face masks, similar to the ones the ambulance crew had been wearing.
"From now on, we wear these at all times outside of the house."
"Seriously?"
balked Lucy.
"Where did you even get those?"
"I told you, the night the satellites went down, I bought everything I could think of. This is something I thought of."
"Dan, how will we eat?"
He finished fitting one of the masks to his face.
"I don't know."
His voice was slightly muffled.
"We'll figure it out."
He held out a mask for Lucy to try on. She looked at her partner, who had in one fell swoop transformed into a surgeon, his mouth and nose covered, all the emotional information vanishing from his face, the only remaining clue being his eyes. As she pulled the elastic bands of her own mask down over her hair, she felt distant from him, sealed off from the intimacies and nuances of her partner's lips. It fits, but I don't like it, she said, taking hers off.
Me neither.
Dan removed his too, and mine's already sweaty, which I'm pretty sure kind of ruins them.
How do you know it's contagious?
Whatever took the old guy down.
I'm guessing, but if the medics are wearing them, it's a safe bet. Dad hinted something like this might be coming. A pandemic of sorts.
Wait, but is it to do with that yellow stuff that was on the ocean? I don't think anyone's ever seen that before.
Dan nodded.
And you didn't think this was worth mentioning before now?
I wasn't sure it was even going to happen, countered Dan. We've had enough to deal with without worrying about some other unknown. Dad only mentioned it towards the end of the call, then we got cut off, so I couldn't find out more.
He said something about possible contamination from the ISS, but that it was speculative. Honestly, Luce, this was a footnote in the conversation I had with him. It was all about getting rations and preparing for martial law. The scenario didn't feature highly.
But now you've decided it's definitely happening?
You saw for yourself. Yellow scum, weird golden seeds, the military staying back, and the medics not even trying to save the guy. When have you ever seen any of those things?
Lucy didn't have an answer, and instead paused to consider. So, she replied after a moment, holding up her mask. What do we do with these, then? If it's in the air, we need to wear them all the time, right? Otherwise, what's the point?
Both of them stared at their masks, unwilling to accept the obvious, logical truth. It was plain to Lucy that neither of them wanted to be wearing the masks at all, let alone in their own home. After some contemplation, she pulled hers back over her face with purpose.
24 hours, ventured Lucy. If it's airborne, it'll spread fast. There'll be announcements. Or bodies. If it's not airborne, then we can take these off at the end of the day.
Dan pulled his on too.
Agreed.
When they woke the next morning, the air was thick with spores. It was like a blizzard, only instead of snow, the haze was comprised of floating seeds, giving it a mustardy hue. Lucy looked at Dan with concern as the two stepped out of their lobby and into the gentle storm, each wearing their protective mask. Lucy put their umbrella up immediately, shielding them from much of the onslaught. Other figures appeared through the haze, some also using umbrellas, although none wearing masks. As she and Dan reached the bus stop, the wind died down and the visibility improved slightly. The spores formed a soft, springy layer underfoot, giving the sidewalks a cushioned quality.
This is my bus, said Dan through his mask. Are you sure you're going to be okay?
Yes. Are you?
Yeah. Promise me you won't take your mask off, he said as the bus doors opened.
I promise. Same goes for you, she replied, grabbing him in a hug before he boarded the bus. Its windshield wipers pushed squashed seeds from side to side as the packed vehicle pulled away. Lucy turned and surveyed the streets around, trying to process the new sepia blanket that covered everything from the tar to the roof of the bus shelter. Her bus came sometime later. Lucy stared out of the window as they drove. Every soldier they passed wore a face mask. Even though the danger in the air outside was visible, she still had to fight the burning urge to rip her mask off as the temperature on board rose with each new wave of workers that got on. A permanent layer of condensed breath had formed a stifling microclimate on the inside of the white shield. Humid droplets now precipitated from the semi-plastic membrane above her nose back down onto her captive lips.
The day was long, her every thought dogged by concerns of hygiene. Each second was but another opportunity to be infected by a colleague, by her food, by the very air she couldn't help but breathe.
Her co-workers asked one after another what the mask was for, but Lucy ignored them, wishing neither to invite further conversation nor to risk someone stealing her only form of protection. She couldn't tell if it was her paranoia or if her colleague down the line was developing the same rattling cough as the old man, but she kept her distance. When finally the time came to return home, it became clear the situation had worsened. Fresh bodies lay scattered along the streets, this time not just the elderly, but the young too. Most were surrounded by concerned onlookers, either trying in vain to help or attempting to flag down other passers-by in their panic. As the bus drove, Lucy began to count the bodies.
6 bodies, she muttered beneath her mask, shaking her head. 6 in 5 minutes and 0 ambulances.
Lucy's bus came to a premature halt and the doors opened. She craned her neck to see the owner of the heavy footsteps that reverberated up each of the bus's metal steps.
A sergeant appeared, a white mask covering the lower portion of his face. He said something brief to the bus driver, then returned to the passengers, megaphone in hand. The sergeant's amplified tone was brisk and assertive, cutting through the mask's muffling effect.
"You are each about to be issued with a face mask. You must wear it at all times. If you know someone who is sick, do not allow them to remove their mask. Do not allow yourself to come into contact with another person's bodily fluids. Remove your mask only when you need to eat and drink. Do not swap masks with anyone else, and do not lose your mask. As of this moment, your mask is your life."
With that, he departed the bus to the shock and confusion of the murmuring passengers on board.
Their voices quickly mounted into a wall of noise and fears, into which a lower-ranking cadet entered, hastily throwing two masks into each row as he traversed the length of the vehicle, not stopping to answer any questions and strenuously avoiding all eye contact. He was off in less than a minute. The doors of the bus closed once again, and it pulled away, passing through the makeshift checkpoint that now stood barring the road. When Lucy's stop came, Dan was waiting for her.
"What are you doing here?" she said, embracing him fiercely as he stepped across the slushy, trampled seed carpet of the sidewalk. Dan clung to her just as intensely.
"I checked the apartment and you weren't there, so I figured I'd come wait for you. I guess I was anxious and..."
He hesitated.
"I guess you saw on the bus back. The walk isn't going to be the nicest."
Lucy nodded, taking his hand as they set off homeward in the fading light. When they arrived, dotted along their street were three bodies, spread at large intervals. They weren't sprawled like the old man's had been. Rather, they had been neatly placed parallel to the edge of the sidewalk. Fresh spores were already settling on top of them.
"Let's get in," said Lucy, picking up the pace.
They reached their darkened building as a family of three were leaving. They were in a state of distress, carrying a smaller, fourth body between them.
"I'm sorry,"
said Dan, casting his eyes downward as he held the main door open for the group. Lucy stepped to the side, unsure of what to do with her hands as the mourners passed. Once the group was clear, she and Dan furiously wiped their shoes on the building mat, removing any traces of seeds. Dan took out his flashlight as they began to climb the unlit stairwell. Lucy's footsteps echoed with his, falling in and out of time with each other, until Dan suddenly froze mid-stride, throwing out a hand behind him to stop Lucy from advancing any further. He faced straight ahead. They'd reached the sixth floor, where a hacking cough above them was growing louder and louder.
"Can you see who it is?"
whispered Lucy, trying to project from behind her mask without being detected by the floor above. Dan shook his head, still rooted to the spot with his arm outstretched, dipping their flashlight. Looking up ahead, Lucy watched as streaks of light from the unseen stranger jerked around erratically. The coughing continued, escalating into almost barking. Lucy shuddered at the victim's pain, palpable as it was in the sound of delicate lung tissue deteriorating amid bronchial spasms. Cries of pain and gasps for air punctured the disturbing overture as it reverberated around the hallway. Finally, the crumpling thud of a body hitting the ground signaled it was over.
"I think they're dead,"
whispered Dan, the whites of his eyes flashing as they darted between Lucy and the ascending spiral of stairs.
"Christ! We have to get past. We can't stay here forever," she whispered back. "And if they're still alive, then we need to call an ambulance."
He looked back and hesitated.
"Dan!"
she hissed urgently.
"All right,"
he whispered back harshly before turning and slowly continuing upwards. As they rounded the lip of the seventh floor, he froze again. Lucy gasped as she too saw Manuela's outstretched body. Bloodshot eyes protruded from her skull, goggling from the exertion of death. The rest of her body was twisted and contorted, lasting evidence of the pain endured. The door to her apartment stood closed behind her, unmoved, the key still clasped in its owner's mottled hand. Around Manuela's other hand was the ribbon attached to her flashlight, which now sent a steady beam of light across the far wall.
"She looks dead,"
said Dan, reaching out and then recoiling, clearly too afraid of contamination to risk taking a pulse.
"Manuela?"
asked Lucy tentatively, afraid the corpse might spring back to life with renewed spluttering and rasping. But Manuela just lay there,
gone.
We can't leave her like this, said Lucy. We need to move her.
Agreed, said Dan, not moving. His eyes were fixed on the victim's face, and Lucy couldn't help but copy. Both of their brains stalled as if forcing them to process the level of anguish contained within each burst capillary, each fraction of an inch that the woman's eyes had edged forth from their sockets. Lucy and Dan had now directly witnessed two people being killed by the disease, and Lucy could only assume the bodies she'd seen from the bus had all suffered the same violent death.
Let's move her, said Dan, snapping out of the trance. We need to get her into the street immediately. The contagion's still in her body. If it was affecting her lungs, then it's in the air here, too.
Yes, right,
replied Lucy, startled by the callousness of her own subconscious as it wandered through the closed apartment door and to the glass Manuela had never returned. She hadn't had to confront death like this in a long time. She'd forgotten what it did to the mind. The two of them carefully stepped over the body and continued up to their dark apartment, where they immediately lit the kitchen candle. Putting on vinyl gloves, they picked up a small stack of trash bags to wrap the body in, and Dan swapped his regular flashlight for his headlamp. Lucy wrote a note with Manuela's first name, address, date, and her approximate time of death on it, as well as the suspected cause of death, which she simply put as virus. They returned to the body, which was exactly as they'd left it, and Lucy taped the note to Manuela's blouse. She was about to close the lady's eyelids, but Dan stayed her hand.
Don't, he said, grabbing her wrist in time. The contagion could be in her fluids, like the guy said on the bus. It'll be in her eyes.
Lucy nodded, and the two of them began negotiating the body into the first trash bag.
What should we do with her flashlight?
Said Lucy, carefully unraveling it from Manuela's wrist.
I don't know, said Dan. Could it be infected?
We could bleach it. I'll leave it next to her door, decided Lucy, switching it off, in case we need it in an emergency.
They continued to package the body, first getting the legs into one bag, then the top half into another, before taping both bags together where they overlapped in the middle.
I'll go first, said Dan, swiveling the body around so the head was just protruding over a lower step.
They carried her body as carefully and respectfully as they could down all seven flights of stairs, but it was hard going. They had to stop on multiple levels just to catch their breath and wipe the sweat from their brows. Lucy couldn't believe how heavy the corpse was. In the back of her mind, she wondered what a stranger would say if they happened to find them like this, but her question was answered when they got outside. Coming out from almost every house on the street were groups, mostly twos and threes, all accepting the same terrible task that had befallen them, bringing the dead out onto the street. Some bodies were wrapped in makeshift shrouds of bedsheets and blankets. Others were completely unchanged, simply being carried in the clothes they'd died in. The one thing all the bodies had in common was the same contorted signs, the same telltale cause of death writ across their twisted, violent final postures. Their deaths had been sudden and brutal. Many of those carrying the bodies were heartbroken, their cries muffled by the masks over which tears now streamed, rolling down onto each mourner's chin and off into nowhere. Lucy's mind flashed to southern Louisiana, to Clinton, her childhood community. Were they suffering in the same way? Were her friends from Wisconsin U now scattered across the country, all caught up in the same awful predicaments? She wondered how many of them were carrying bodies now. Who of them was crying? Who would be putting on a brave face? Who might be the first to die? Unsure what else to do, they lay Manuela's body out on the sidewalk, as others had done, parallel to the road. Feet, said Lucy as they returned to the building. She stopped in the entrance and scraped the spores off the soles of her shoes with repeated heavy drags across the rough mat. Dan did the same. A lone man overtook them as they reached the stairs, hurrying up to his second-floor home, locking the door behind him loudly as if doing so might offer better protection against the invisible disease. As they reached the eighth floor, the main lights came back on. Neither of them said anything. The curfew alarm sounded as Dan re-entered the bedroom, holding one towel around his waist, while pressing another into his dripping hair. They'd both seized upon the narrow window of electricity that had opened up shortly after they'd returned home. Lucy had gone first and was now enjoying the luxury of a hairdryer, its warmth gradually offsetting the bracing cold of the shower water.
Dan said something unintelligible through his mask, so she paused the dryer.
You sure you're okay? He repeated.
Yeah, it's just bad memories, that's all, she replied.
Your dad? Lucy nodded.
Not been that close to a dead body until today, which is a good thing, I guess.
Well, yesterday, if you count the old man.
Dan gave her a sympathetic shoulder squeeze as she resumed her drying by the window. She peered out at the street below, at the lame cars partially illuminated by the light spilling out of the lower floor apartments. This was the first time the power had been on after curfew, and the city authorities had cut the streetlights. Perhaps they were seeking to avoid any conflicts of interest, thought Lucy, or perhaps they wanted to hide what was happening.
Dan?
She said, calling him over.
He came over to the window, and the two of them watched as a pair of masked soldiers climbed out of a truck and began retrieving the bodies lining the street. The pair struggled under the weight. One soldier tripped against the sidewalk and dropped his half, fumbling immediate attempts to relift it as his partner continued dragging the body. There was no ceremony about it. The soldiers were rushing. Lucy quickly counted the number of bodies left on the darkened street and extrapolated an average death toll for their block. 30, at least. As the truck pulled away, it joined a convoy of similar trucks passing down the adjacent main road. She considered how many streets there were in San Francisco and how many people might be dying on each one at that very moment. They took advantage of the power to tune in to KGO 810 again. A different presenter's voice filled the airwaves, her soft tone at odds with the chilling confirmation that the pathogen or toxin, no one knew quite what it was yet, was airborne. The presenter stated that people were linking the deaths to the newly appeared spores, although this had not been scientifically verified. However, the report did confirm that the spores were originating from the yellow scum covering the beachfront.
Symptoms of infection include prickly skin, fever, dizziness, seeing bright spots, blurry vision, and sweating, said the anchor dispassionately. If you think you're developing symptoms, quarantine yourself immediately. Stay away from people and pets until 24 hours have passed. If you're still alive after 24 hours, then you're likely to be okay. She added, an unmistakable tone of doubt creeping into her voice. If you do have the virus, continued the presenter, it will likely kill you within 3 hours.
That's not especially encouraging, remarked Dan, busily counting the rations again. Lucy listened until the news was finished, then turned the radio off.
You hear that last bit? She asked Dan. We have to report to City Hall again for reassignment.
What I don't get, said Dan, taking off a stack of tins, is why you have to quarantine yourself for 24 hours if the disease kills you within 3.
Lucy considered. Maybe symptoms come on slower on some people. Or it could be the incubation period, she mused. That's almost certainly why they've closed the schools.
I remember when I was growing up, ruminated Dan. If one kid got sick, everyone had it within a week.
Maybe that's why we're being reassigned. It's got to be thousands of parents who now have to stay home and look after their kids. Quite a hit to the workforce.
Maybe, replied Dan. Or maybe it's because the workers have started dying. We've had people dying on my job. I guess it's the same at yours. Maybe the state knows where this is headed.
As she lay in bed next to Dan later that evening, staring up at the ceiling, she repeatedly resisted the urge to adjust the mask on her face. Hyper-aware of the elastic digging into the skin beneath her ears, the goggles covering her eyes were no better. Dan had insisted they wear them too now that they knew the disease was airborne, but each new layer of protection only made her feel less secure. Her eyes eventually grew heavy. Her mind wandered to an old childhood memory of her parents arguing. She was in her small bed, clutching her favorite teddy bear and singing to it to try to block out the shouting. She couldn't see either of her parents. They weren't in the room, but the walls of the house were like paper, and her father's voice carried. She couldn't remember what they were arguing about, so her mind invented nonsense conversations instead. Angry, muffled syllables invaded the four walls. Footsteps approached in a hurry. Her bedroom door flew open, setting the bells on the handle jingling. Her mother ran to Lucy's bedside and scooped her up, carrying her out into the corridor.
Lucy squinted, remembering how bright the hall lights had felt. Her father's voice continued to yell incoherently, closer now as her mom carried her through the house and out to the car.
"She's coming with me!"
cried her mother as she lowered Lucy into the passenger seat. Lucy pressed a hand to her cheek, then pulled it away. It was wet and black with her mother's running mascara. Her mom turned on the ignition, but the car wouldn't start. She tried again and again to no avail. She turned to Lucy.
"Mom, we'll be back in 1 minute, baby,"
she said, and got out of the car, closing the door behind her. Lucy blinked and opened her eyes. Her heart was racing. The room was darker now. She had no idea how long she'd been asleep, but the dream had been vivid. The argument in it had been real enough. Such fallouts had been daily, right up until her mother left. But her mom had never tried to take Lucy with her. And in that moment, in the darkness, after 20 years of living without the woman, it hurt like hell. Dan lay stretched out next to her, a million miles away, lost in his own thoughts and fears. Lucy moved her hand over to meet his and squeezed it hard, holding on with no intention of letting up. He reciprocated sleepily and rolled over towards her.
"Are you okay?"
he mumbled.
"Yeah,"
she said, squeezing her eyes shut and taking a deep breath, stemming the tears that were pooling in her goggles. She quickly flipped both lenses up a couple of millimeters, allowing the salty water to drain away down her cheeks. He gently raised his hand to her face.
"You're crying,"
he said softly and scooped her up in his arms, his mask resting on her shoulder. She clung to him, scared that her present was slipping away from her, scared that her past was catching up with her, and terrified that she was experiencing every symptom of the disease at once. She focused on regulating her breathing as waves of anxiety smothered her. The radio report began to play over and over in her mind. She searched for solace, trying mindfulness, distraction, anything and everything she could to lower her pulse and alleviate the crushing sensation across her chest. Finally, a single thought allowed her to sleep. If either of them was infected, they'd both be dead by morning, and the fear would be over.